I want to discuss about a certain application of some of the things that Jan discussed, and which is specific application which includes fermions, and is the model was chosen because of biogenesis motivated questions, but I will explain that, and it appeared last month on the web. So to summarize what has been said, and to say also some controversial things, which well, I'll just give a quick summary, and to about two approximations which have been used and which might be related, might not be related, but anyhow. First of all, we heard several talks about the classical approximation, and that was basically we could split it in thermal equilibrium, being classical thermal equilibrium, of course, which would especially consider the Phelan rate, and also out of equilibrium, which was applied to inflation calculations, let's say. So the good thing is about having inhomogeneous classical fields, at least what I consider to be good things, is that you actually have Phelan transitions, because these are inhomogeneous field configurations, so that is present. And that there is that there is scattering, although it's a classical scattering, but could argue that, we heard some arguments that it would be good if the occupation numbers are high. Then this turned out to be like an alien with question marks on his head. There are some things to worry about and to have questions about, which is the cutoff dependence, for instance, especially in thermal equilibrium. You know, you have the Rayleigh-Jeans divergence, so that's something to worry about. And that there are no quantum effects present. I put this between quotes because if the low-lying modes are highly occupied, then the quantum effects might be captured in a good way by the classical effects. So, but in principle, there are no real quantum effects present. The way it's presented. Well, okay. You could worry about that. And the other approximation, which has received a lot of attention, summarizes a large N or Hartree approximation. It's mainly been applied to out-of-equilibrium situations, inflation, strong mean fields. The good thing is here that you can derive it from first principles using closed-time path contour, and then it leads to renormalizable effective equations of motions. And here, renormalizable means in the normal zero-temperature quantum field theory sense. So you really do quantum field theory in a way. So, however, which is what we considered to be things you can have questions about, is that the emphasis, especially in numerical calculations, has been on homogeneous mean fields. Well, first of all, this excludes inhomogeneous classical configurations, such as kinks, which you will hear more about tomorrow, I guess, Phelan, bubbles, and things like that. And the second thing is that there is no mode mixing between the fluctuations which are treated with the mode expansion, and this especially makes the, well, at least in my opinion, long-time behavior look, the long-time behavior is in a certain way, which is basically governed by the fact there is no mode mixing, I would say. So, but I would... That's leading order. I'm only discussing here leading order. So what I will discuss is large N expansion with inhomogeneous mean fields, which hopefully captures good things in both approximations. First of all, there are inhomogeneous classical field configurations present, so you have phalerons and things like that. And secondly, that we have, for instance, renormalizable effective equations of motion, and we have mode mixing because of the inhomogeneous mean fields. So, to give the outline of the talk, first I will just very briefly discuss what the physical problem is, which is related to the problem of baryogenesis. We'll then describe the model, which was already introduced by Jan this morning, and show the effective equations of motion, and then spend quite some time, I think, on numerical results we have obtained for Phelan transitions, renormalizability, non-equilibrium dynamics, the long-time behavior, which is very long-time behavior, and finally Pauli blocking. So that's what I want to do. So First, the motivation, which comes from barogenesis. I can be very quick here because it has been discussed quite a lot, and also with fermions it has been discussed by Alek Krasnich. So the classical cartoon is like this. There is a sphalerons, there's a non-trivial vacuum structure, there are sphalerons in between, which are is an inhomogeneous classical configuration, and the anomaly equation relates the baryon number, the change in baryon number, to the change in Chern-Simons number. And a lot of people, well, some people have worked on the sphaleron rate, which is the rate with which the Chern-Simons number changes in the classical approximation. So now we want to include fermions. First of all, it's interesting because all the classical Bose calculations have concentrated on calculating the change in Chern-Simons number, but now we can actually calculate the, well, the left-hand side of this equation, so that's funny, I would say. Then include the fermion Dec reaction, and possibly, well, I won't discuss it, but also maybe introduce CP violation in the fermions to have a really realistic barogenesis scenario. And, well, as Alek Krasnich already showed, this cartoon changes when the fermions are present. So the framework is, we have inhomogeneous Bose fields, which are, let's say, the mean fields, and we have fermion field representing the fluctuations, so schematically like this. And for this, we think we can use a large end approximation, which is very similar as in QED with large number of fermions. Just as a side remark here, that if you would do this, well, we do it in 1 plus 1 dimension, but if you would do it in 3 plus 1 dimensions, this would include the Hartzell loop correction to the gauge field, both to the gauge field propagator due to the fermion loop. So the model is the Abelian-Higgs model in 1 plus 1 dimensions. This, I'm now repeating what Jan already told you. So this gauge field, Higgs field, Mexican head potential, there are fermions which are coupled with a gamma 5, and there's this Yukawa coupling giving the fermions a mass if the Higgs has an expectation value. The space is a circle, periodic boundary condition for the Bose fields and antiperiodic for the fermions. There is fermion number violation, which relates the fermion number to the change in Chern-Simons number. Because we want to use a lattice formulation, it's convenient to transform it to a vector-like theory, so get rid of the gamma 5 in the fermion coupling. This can be done by using performing charge conjugation on the right-handed fields, and you end up with a standard path which literally looks like QED in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and a funny Yukawa coupling term, which is a Majorana coupling. So it's now also convenient to use Majorana fermions, and I will show you then the result on the next transparency. And furthermore, the what was the fermion number in the original formulation is now the axial charge in the new formulation. So the anomaly equation is now the change in axial charge is the change in the Chern-Simons number. But you can just think about it as being fermion number.
Given the power coupling capital G, I guess, now the number flavor goes to infinity, right?
Yeah.
So does it actually mean that what is kept constant is G times N?
It's G divided by square root of N. So when I will derive the equation very quickly, I will do a rescaling of the coupling constant and of the fields, which is usually done in this framework. Okay. But I will come to that. So
what is the anomaly equation on the lattice in this relation? Do you worry about that?
Yeah, we will worry about that. I will show you that. Yeah. So I said we were going to do this on the lattice. Now, why, you might ask. First of all, the lattice spacing is the gauge invariant ultraviolet cutoff, and since we're doing the quantum theory, or an approximation to the quantum theory, you need an ultraviolet cutoff to regularize all the divergences. So that's one thing. And furthermore, exact symmetries in the lattice action correspond to exactly conserved currents. And these currents and charge are conserved for finite letter spacing. So you don't have to take it's not conserved in the limit that the letter spacing goes to zero, but it's conserved for finite letter spacing, which just makes it numerically a good good check on your numerics, for instance. And furthermore, the equations of motion which follow from the lattice action are, first of all, they are relatively simple, and they lead to a stable integration algorithm, which is absolutely necessary because we're going to solve a huge number of partial differential equations. So the action now looks like this. The gauge field and the Higgs field haven't changed, except that all the derivatives are lattice derivatives or lattice covariant derivatives. So it's a non-compact formulation. And this is the fermion part, which just looks very standard, except these are Majorana fermions, which is the covariant derivative on the Majorana fermion. This W I will come back to, and this is the Higgs, standard Higgs coupling. So the number of lattice points is n, lattice spacing is a, and so the total length is n times a. Lattice spacing in time and in space are different. Typically, this one is 0.1 times that one, or 0.05 times that one. Then I introduce the Majorana-Dirac Hamiltonian, because that will come back, which simply is the standard thing which follows from this action with the space derivatives and a mass term here. Well, you already mentioned them, of course. If you put it on a fermion on a lattice, you have the problem of lattice doublers. So I will talk about that.
What values of B squared does it have? B squared being the Higgs expectation versus square?
Well, between 4 and 10 B squared.
Because from what we discussed in the previous hour, it looks like what you're doing is in classical approximation.
Yeah.
And this should be good when the coupling constant is small.
Yeah.
The coupling constant being 1 over
B squared. 1 over B squared, right. Yeah. So you can actually scale V squared out to put it in front of the fermion contribution, so you can see how much how big the fermion effect is.
But can you force the same classical set equation by taking a large number of fermions, taking less energy?
They're all the same way.
The fermions are now the same order as the positive field.
Yeah. And in position, you can monitor the relative strength by the field.
But then these are not entirely equivalent. No. Or they are completely equivalent.
No.
These are different. It's sort of turning different now.
Yeah. So once we have the equations, we can still vary V squared and enlarge of the influence of the fermions or not. So fermion doublers, where do they come from? Well, they come from the fact that you want to discretize the first order derivative. And how you do that, which is, motivated, because you do it in a symmetric way, because this leads to an Hermitian action which has kind of nice properties. But so this in a symmetric way means that you take the half of the forward derivative and the backward derivative, which in the continuum limit would give you just one derivative here. So the forward derivative is like this at next point minus the point you're interested in, and the backward is like the point minus the point back. So it looks at this. However, this relation here, if you put it on the right-hand side, let's say you do this for time, like here, this involves three different points. It involves x plus a, x, let's say here, and here, x minus a. So what this means is that there are more solutions to the equations of motion, or more properly stated maybe, that there are more poles in the propagator than what you expect. So one way to see this is look at the Dirac equation, which I've written here just for free fields. And now let's first look at the spatial part of this. But basically it becomes an eigenvalue problem for the Dirac Hamiltonian. If you now calculate what the eigenvalues are, you find that they, as a function of p, that they look like this. So around here they have the normal linear relations, but then it bends over and it goes down to zero again. So if you're interested in the low energy, let's say low energy solutions which correspond to the physical particles, you not only have these normal solutions, but you also have solutions over here. And these are the, call them here space doublers, and they are, they lie at the edge of the Brillouin zone. It's an eye there. And this can be cured, there are, in the Euclidean context, of course, it's been known for a long time, and there are several ways to cure fermion problems. And one way is to do is to add a higher derivative term to the action, which is the Wilson, Kiedkiewicz-Wilson fermions. And what this higher derivative term does is it does nothing around here, but around the edge of the Brillouin zone, it changes the dispersion relation in this way, which means that only the normal particles are left over, and that the doublers at these size, they disappear from the physical low energy spectrum, which is around here now only. So this completely kills the doublers which are in the space directions. We also tried this same thing for the time directions, but we didn't get very satisfactory answers. So here we do something else, which is can be understood if you look at this. If you now look at what the frequencies are of this, just the free Dirac equation, you find that there are more frequencies instead of what you would expect. First of all, there's just the positive-negative frequency equal to the positive of negative energy, which are just the normal particles. So the free field just oscillates like this. But there is one more or two more solutions which go like 1 over the lattice spacing in time. And there is just E. And if you look at what this thing does, it does this. It's a rapidly oscillating factor, minus 1, which changes with every time step, times a slowly varying, let's say, physical frequency. So what this looks like is that it just looks like a normal particle, except there is this rapidly oscillating prefactor in front of it. Now, and what is, what you can call naive fermions is to really take this new solution seriously and interpret it as a true particle, except that you have to be careful about these minus ones, which will show up in the observables.
Are you in time? No.
Well, if you take it not to zero and you look at the... Well, for any non-zero lattice spacing, it will show up in the observables. And what it does, for instance, is that the solution... this solution will have an opposite axial charge if you take just the normal axial charge. So this, the time doubler will also, for instance, cancel the anomaly. So for any non-zero lattice spacing in time.
And this is occurring at a frequency which is going to infinity, at 1 over the time.
This will go more rapid, but this part survives.
If you measure time in time steps of 2 at the time, which you might do, then they're all there. Mm-hmm. They don't go away. So, and if you take a continuous time limit, you take a smooth initial field in the latitudes, then you take the limit, then they disappear.
Decouples.
But taking limits is like you cannot do that in numerics. So you always find their effects after some time, even if you didn't introduce them.
So suppose that you had formulated this in the continuum time Hamiltonian formula. Then there would be no problem, but then if you wanted to do a simulation, you said it would pop up.
Yeah. This would die again.
Because you had. So, and you could not be cured by having a decent algorithm for the continuum time. Because you can make it precise for any order you like in principle, in the time domain. It doesn't have to be a delta T implementation. You could take a delta T to the 500 and increase, and it was simple.
I believe so, because you have this idea of anomaly cancellation. There's no anomaly on the lattice in the lattice field equation, because they're discretized and they're
magic.
So if you don't deal with it properly, you will find that maybe after gigantic times, if you have a gigantically good algorithm, that your anomaly is washed out by funny excitations, which are the analog of these doublers, time doublers.
But can't you do something like a time filtering to get rid of these high frequency doubler modes?
I believe it's easier just to deal with them the way we did. I think that's the simplest way. And we haven't tried other ways.
It's now
it's actually not wise to do it, but that's experience from the Euclidean.
Now it's relatively straightforward because you just take these doublers seriously. You use the simple discretization, and you know they're there, so you take them into account.
And I'm still a bit puzzled about it. You have a system of differential equations,
mm-hmm.
right, which you integrate in time. Mm-hmm. Now, in that system, you do not have natural frequencies. You have some limit of natural, have the highest natural frequencies present in the system. So how does this enormous frequency that you're talking about come about? I just operationally cannot follow through. You have a system of differential equations, which has its own natural frequency.
Yeah, you just time step it forward in some
arbitrarily
fine way. And
then the non-linearities introduce higher and higher frequencies.
I mean, it's not altogether obvious that you have this.
Okay, well, I have...
There. I mean, it must depend on how you discretize.
But I can. They do come about because first of all we didn't take them seriously, and we just took only the let's say this part of the, just look at the standard axial charge without doing difficult things. And then so you know how to initialize these, which is very smoothly in time, so that they're not present initially. But if you then wait, the anomaly then comes out correctly because you have. You're just describing basically continuum physics in time. But then after some time, you would see that the axial charge would go to zero again and would not follow.
You're looking at the dispersion, the linearized dispersion relation in the discretized space and time lattice.
Mm-hmm.
And then the statement is there are these doubler modes.
And so I give you an example now that they do arise. If you run the system long enough, which was not very long, let's say, they did arise and they did cancel the anomaly. So it...
We tried to build some way in time as well. It didn't work. You still have the time doublers, but you can't even interpret them as normal particles anymore. So
you can write down some Hamiltonian for this system. This Hamiltonian, you can probably linearize it and find its frequency
spectrum. Right,
how common is this frequency spectrum? So there are arbitrarily high frequencies present in that spectrum.
Oh, this equation here allows two solutions.
Yeah.
So it's just... And even if you start with only the low frequency solution, because in the interacting case there is here a gauge field in the Dirac Hamiltonian and the Higgs field, and then it would be generated by the nonlinearities.
But that's true, you can do it the way you want, it should continue, but I'm just remarking that I think this is a well known numerical issue where there are ways to filter high frequency solutions out that you don't want. You didn't do that, so let's just go on.
I don't know. I actually don't know
the
ways, but okay. In the interacting case, I think I'd be, well, in a way we did it. We did filter. We measured a certain time steps, and then we found that each time, after a long time, Q5, which ought to be following the Chern-Simons number you're showing me, didn't follow it anymore, which went to zero, and that the interpretation is the double mode started coming on. And I can imagine this happening in any discretization in time, which you have to do anyway, but it gets more and more obscure what's actually happening, because this happens also in the Euclidean case, where you have people have tried very sophisticated discretization, saying, now we have got rid of the Fermion double, but no, you have some screwy excitations which cannot be interpreted as particles anymore, but they still act, you can analyze it as a perturbation theory, they still act in such a way as to cancel the anomaly.
I mean, basically, if I recall, the way to do it is to have an implicit time step. And if you just do it directly the way you're doing it, you will, of course, have this. But if you make the step, there's some implicit relation that you solve, which basically puts a boundary condition in that removes the high frequency part. I think this is a numerical quotes. I have to do it.
It's not just depression, it's numeric. Your Hamiltonian needs, of course, the presented system that has a true anomaly if you do it.
But as you were saying, if you had an arbitrarily fine time step of the Hamiltonian evolution, then there's no time delta, right?
It's not arbitrarily long, but we know that this problem is whenever you go from continuum. I mean, there are continuum regularizations that cannot be so easily generalized to.
But the Euclidean problem is different. I mean, this is a Cauchy problem. You're evolving something forward in time.
But that's the same. If you have a setup where the anomaly is not really present or doesn't take the value it should take, I mean.
But the anomaly is of course there on the spatial basis, as it should be.
Yes.
I mean, at the moment you have a continuous time, this is a complete anomaly, and there's nothing else. Now you have to solve the differential equation, and you introduce some kind of discretization. So with this one, it seems that somehow some strange temporal things come up. So the only thing you ask is it really necessary for it to come up? I would say not, but clearly if you can deal with just like this, this is fine.
The other reason for doing it this way is that if you start with a space-time lattice, you really have your whole path in the goal is there regularized in front of your eyes. So
I agree. It's very convenient. I use it myself. I agree.
The
peril of really very stupid question, but. Yeah, there are fermions, so we would like to simulate them, but what is it you're really after here? I mean, normally people think that the fermion part of the determinant is not so important for the Scott-Lagrange, right? But you have some reason to think otherwise, or what's the main motivation of trying to understand for doing all this work on the fermion?
It's just nice to be able to simulate the big system, FHCP violation, let it fall down its non-equilibrium path, and then just measure in the end how many fermions have been created. That would be a very nice.
Yeah, just directly calculate the fermion number.
All these fights that Shaposhnikov and Farrar and the other people, there were all these fights going on. Do we include the dumping? Don't we include the dumping? You remember
you're not going to touch that issue, right? Because it's still a weakly coupled. That has to do with other issues.
This would be non-interesting.
With the Higgs present, yeah.
I guess what I'm asking is there any reason to think that the standard lore that fermions are not so important in the Scott-Lagrange rate is wrong?
But if
they just track the transimons.
We are interested in physics, after all.
I'm just asking,
we are interested in fermion physics, fermion number violation. Now, you can't all the time kick out the fermions and then talk about it. It's like QCD without fermions. It's like topological susceptibility QCD addressing the U1 problem. It is an approximation, but in the end, you want to do the real thing.
But you're going to do log n, which is a different... Not the real thing
either. It's another approximation to the real thing. Yeah.
Play about
I was wondering if there any information that says the fermions are really going to change the spell on rate.
In Alex's talk, that was.
There is something, people think they know about the lore, like you say.
Right.
The lore is that. Well, first, the fermion does not change substantially the solar energy unless they're heavy. Now, nobody really knows how, or at least some of them are running calculations where people really determine how the fermions change the determinant, the solar determinant, the frequency determinant around the solar. So that you first calculate the effective theory, you integrate all the fermions, and then in that effective theory, to determine the rate. Mm-hmm. I don't think this has ever been done.
High temperature phase, low temperature phase?
Low temperature phase. So you change the potential, then you determine the correct rate with the correct potential.
With the correct potential corrected by fermion density?
Corrected, we integrate the fermion density.
that there is a small effect and there is a considerably bigger effect. The small effect that there is a fermion density and the potential is sort of not flattened the direction but sort of rises to the side.
No, I'm not talking about density. I'm talking about the
okay, this is a small
effect. We're just talking about quantum fluctuations and the standard statement is that this is a small effect for reasons that
on the solar and energy. How about
and the rate, I think. It's not supposed to change the brief factor by a lot.
The biggest thing thing in brief factor is assembled basically by counting zero modes. The factor of temperature and how many per power the coupling function. So
well, shall I continue? And so the point is just at the high.
Because after all, the anomaly is intrinsically linked to the chiral behavior in four dimensions, right? C plus one dimension. And it really matters if it's C plus one dimension, if you have a continuous description or if you discretize one or several dimensions. And it's not so obvious that you can have a lattice where you have the correct anomaly.
I don't want to argue this point now. I think there are ways, other ways to handle it.
There may be, but...
Okay. So, to summarize, this is that for the space doubles, we add a Wilson term, which is this high derivative term, so which effectively acts as a mass term in the Dirac Hamiltonian, and the time doublers are naive, so they are interpreted as a second flavor.
But
yeah. Well, we started out with Wilson fermions in space and time, and then found that in time it was not so convenient to do that, and then came up with this. But I mean, now you would probably do something else, or maybe you stagger fermions or something like that. So it's just how it's.
You're doing nothing. You're doing nothing. Do not add the Wilson term. Just use naive fermions.
That's
like Stagger's
firm. Yeah.
It would be even better in hindsight.
Yeah, but this is an historic.
Okay,
so. Well, this I only need to show because what you asked. This is the same, basically the same conspiracy Jan showed. So, is that you rescale the fields and the coupling constants by factors of square root of n to bring out one n in front of this whole action, and then you can calculate the effective saddle point effective action, let's say. So this is what you said.
And the point is this will, of course, automatically make the fermion-back reaction the same order.
Yeah.
And so the point I was asking is whether or not that is
well, that's a good approximation.
We think that's a reasonable approximation, but the standard thing say it's not.
No, you can still make the correction, the back reaction bigger and smaller by tuning the coupling constant in front.
First of all, it's a polynomial. Second, you have a lot of fermions in the standard.
I mean, everybody has focused on classical Bose fields. So we're extended it with quantum fermion field. So I mean,
no, it's a good thing to do, really.
So the effective equations then look like this. Yeah.
Not to remind about this question about G, because before you were about to show that you already showed that.
I mean, it was just rescaling to bring out the correct factor of nf in front of the action.
So what remains constant in the large m limit is this capital G times m, or
sure.
Yeah. So this G goes by one of the
other. Yeah. So it's like it's weak. So this scaled e tilde, this one stays constant. So this is the one which appears in the effective equations of motion. That's kept constant. But this, so you would say this goes to infinity. So the original coupling constant should be very small. Like, so it's recoupling in the original
theory. But the currents are rescaled, so it makes a finite effect.
And that guarantees that, what I was already worried about is the following. Consider your scale of potential with the presence of the fermion. So you have some expectation value for the sidebar sign, whatever it stands, it's not defined. Okay, this introduces a linear term in your scalar potential. Now, if the coefficients in front of this linear term get big, then it completely distorts your scalar potential. It's not a maximum heading.
Mm-hmm.
But is that avoided by this risk?
Yeah, I think it is, because phi is scaled up. Well, in the Yukawa, you mean in the Yukawa term? No, it's like, if you look at this term, it's this term. So G is scaled, phi is scaled in opposite ways, so that this formally keeps the same form as what it was before.
Which means it's not small. It's kept as a finite
correction. It's kept as a finite correction, yeah.
It's not scaled down to zero, like 1 over n.
Yeah, so then it would dominate.
No, it'll be at the same order.
So it's not unnaturally big in the scaled model, and neither small. It's just what it is, of the same order. But so it implies weak coupling in the original Yukawa coupling, and an high amplitude, let's say, for this field in the original terms. But in such a way that the combination is of the same order of all as all the other terms that which are kept. So it doesn't change the picture which you have from without rescaling, let's say. Well, except that the fermions are also present. But yeah?
The finite density is fine.
So, I mean, if you look at the equation, so now the NF has completely disappeared because it was in front of the whole action. So now you just have equations where everything is, let's say, of order 1, which is present in these equations. So this is the equations for the Higgs field, which is just the standard classical equations, including the phi cube term from the Mexican hat. Yeah.
You see that the last term is still there.
This, and this last term is still there, which is the...
You have left out the tildes, right?
I have left out the tildes. This is in the rescaled. So
these are tildes.
So these are the rescaled fields, let's say. But now, in the classical case, you would just have this equation. Now the effect of the fermions is... say enhanced by having a large number of fermions, so the fermion back reaction is present here. Similarly, for the equations for the gauge field, everything is in the A0 equals 0 gauge. So this is the classical Higgs current plus the fermion Higgs current and the Gauss law also. So all these, the fermion back reaction is denoted by these brackets, so that's the current which is. Which looks like this, but then on the lattice, so there is, like points. These fields are point split, you can say, and there is a force on the scalar field, which I denote by F, which is this form, this force. Now the question is how to calculate this this back reaction, and here we use what is called mode function expansion, which in the continuum you would do the following. This is a quantum field. You would expand in a complete set of eigenspinners of the initial Dirac Hamiltonian times coefficients, and these coefficients are time independent, and these are the creation and annihilation operators of the quantum theory. At t equals 0, this is a complete set where the set is labeled by alpha, and for later times these mode functions just evolve by the Dirac equation, where in the Dirac Hamiltonian both the fields and the gauge fields are present. And expectation values of these operators, B, dagger, and B, give the initial quantum states of the system. So these are time-independent operators. Now, on the lattice, we can basically do the same thing, except, as I explained, how we do it with the problem of doublets in time, that we just interpret them as new particles, particles. So this means that we not only have mode functions for the ordinary particles, but also for the time doublets. And that is to say, at time equals zero, we can say that one set of mode functions correspond to the particles and the other set correspond to the doublets. But at later time, everything becomes mixed up because of non-linearity, and it's not, you cannot separate this is particles, this is doublets, but you still know that you have everything present which follows from, well, I didn't say that, but if you do if you construct a fermionic Hilbert space and apply a transfer matrix to do time evolution, you see that you're not doing anything wrong, basically. So, and the mode functions, so the mode functions have a label F, which is, a, let's say, a flavor label. So it's not the NF, which is now away, but just for up and down, for the ordinary and the doublers. And you solve these mode functions, like just using the Lattice-Dirac equation. But up to now, this label alpha here, which labels this complete set, was arbitrary, but it's convenient to start with a complete set of eigenspinors of the Dirac Hamiltonian, which is a simple Dirac Hamiltonian that's, let's say, in a background of gauge fields, of both fields, which is like this, so no gauge field and phi is in its expectation value, because then you can calculate the eigenspinors time equals zero analytically by the just plain waves times some eigen, times some spinor, and so the label alpha, which sums the complete set, is now explicit to be the label for the momentum for a parameter which is plus of minus, and which gives the mixing between the two mass terms in the Dirac Hamiltonian, that's the Wilson mass term and the Yukawa coupling, and then the label F saying the whether you have the up of the ordinary of the doubler at time equals zero. So we take this as the initial mode functions, and then solve the equations, the Dirac equation for these mode functions, and then you can calculate everything is unspecified, so that you can calculate this back reaction by taking, which then if you fill in these expansion mode functions, this thing will typically become a sum over all mode functions which are present. So let's now come to the first application, which is the check of the anomaly equation. So an intuitive picture you can have is by looking at a simpler model with zero Yukawa coupling, which is then this model reduced to just a Schwinger model. And there you can actually just do everything analytically, calculate a spectrum, which is here. And if you now change the Church-Simons number as an external field, let's say, and you see, we'll see that there is level crossing. So this, the states on this, states on this branch go up, states on this branch go down, and states which seem to disappear here come back on this side. And if you go from one Church-Simons number to the other, you find that there is a net amount of axial charge generated. So here the plus and the minus basically gives the sign of the actual charge, and here you have a precise cancellation. These one cancel, these one, etc. But here you see you have two more on this side, which are not cancelled on this side. So you have created actual charge or baryogenesis. This is for a simple model where you can calculate everything by hand. So what we will do now is use external Bose fields to test the fermion part of the model, and take a set of configurations which is inhomogeneous, namely configurations which interpolate between a vacuum state, go to a sphaleron, and go further on towards the next vacuum state, and do this for several states in a row. So the question is, how do the fermions react? Well, this you. Okay, well, this is just a schematic view of what the configurations look like. So I scaled, this is T is the real time, let's say, and this T is a reference time which tells you how fast you feed these external fields to the fermions. And at T prime equals zero, you are in a vacuum state, T prime is a half, you're at a sphaleron, which is basically for the Higgs field, like the kink. And at T prime equals 1, you're in the next vacuum state. So just Simons number is 1. The Higgs has 1 winding number. And then continue. But it's better to look at it in pictures. So this is the configuration or a characterization of the configuration. This is just Simons number, which has some time dependence. This is the energy, the potential energy normalized with sphaleron energy. So here you're precisely on top of the sphaleron, and here is the winding number which changes at every sphaleron transition. So what comes out then is the following, and this is for non-zero Yukawa coupling, so you cannot do it by hand. Here are the Chern-Simons number and the axial charge, and well, this wiggling is determined by the time dependence of the Chern-Simons. But what you see is that the axial charge follows the Chern-Simons number. Well, you can't really see two curves, but there is, for instance, here you see the other curve, which is Chern-Simons number coming out of there. So basically, this is saying that the anomaly equation is satisfied here. Of course, you see here these thick lines, which are actually, if you zoom in, these are the rapid oscillations which were discussed. Because, so here's a blow-up of this interval. So here are three lines, again, the Chern-Simons number, which is the straight line, and then two wiggling lines. And this is for two values of the letter spacing in time, 0.1 and 0.05, and the big fluctuations are for 0.1. And, well, if you look carefully, you will see that the frequency goes like 1 over a squared, which was expected, and also that the amplitude of the oscillation goes down with a zero squared, which you can calculate, let's say, if you're in a free case, or you can estimate that this should happen. So this is just, a feeling that the doublers, which are present because we included them, but they are just producing these rapid oscillations on top of the slowly varying line, which is the physical line. So if you would look at this on timescales longer than the letter spacing, of course, you would do kind of an averaging and you would just see the anomaly equation. Yeah, 1 over a, yeah, I said a squared. Yeah, 1 over a. There is an anomaly on the lattice, yeah. So if I would, so I take the correct, axial charge, but takes into account this minus one effect, so that, I just take the axial charge, which in the continuum limit gives the correct anomaly, let's say. And here it is present, yeah. No. So it's the same. So the axial charge is the same for the good modes and for doublers. They just add up. So there's no anomaly cancellation or something. So we don't have to separate it because that's it's impossible to separate it because after some time everything becomes mixed up. So you can't really tell which one is a doubler and which one is a good mode.
No, it's my question. You can define the T5 in a given
the Q5. Yeah.
It's not a naive one because that would cut to zero, but it's like a staggered one.
It's like staggered fermions with two flavors, and then. Okay, another funny thing is the periodicity of the lattice, because you only have of Q5, you only have a finite number of degrees of freedom. So if I would continue to change my Chern-Simons number, well, these go out and come back on this side. In the end, they would all end up here. And this, as you can see, all these states are now in the plus branch, so this one has the maximal Q5 which can happen. And if you then continue, these would come down and come in here again. And this this particular situation is exactly zero Q5 again, because these cancel. This is, of course, a lattice artifact because you only have a finite number of lattice points, but still it should come out. So this is what's shown here. And this is scaled in such a way that for different n, the curves fall on top of each other. So it's Q5 divided by n and T divided by n, because obviously it takes longer for larger n. And what you see is that indeed, these curves fall on top of each other. You can calculate the maximum, which is 2 over pi, and that agrees. So this is just, of course, the continuum behavior would be here, but also for these large values of Chern-Simons number, it still has to come out correctly like this. Then we have, this one particular plot was for zero Yukawa coupling. If you look at finite Yukawa coupling, for large changes of the Chern-Simons number, you find that there is a, the larger you take your Kawa coupling, then Q5 behaves dramatically different, and it doesn't, well, so the continuum limit is anyhow here, not here, but still it starts to deviate from the Chern-Simons number if you take too large your Kawa coupling, which is, well, we interpret it as being a fact of that the discretization errors are too are still too big for this value of lattice points. And why is that? Because if we do the same run for a bigger lattice, so smaller lattice spacing, 16, 32, 64, you see that this curve will converge towards this Chern-Simons number curve.
Why is the Chern-Simons number monotonically always increasing? Never goes the other way.
Well, it's an external field, so just take it like that. But because, well, one thing is that, of course, the lattice has a finite number of states, so the Q5 must go down eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not so. This whole region is not a physical region anyhow, because here you really see the effect of having only a finite number of states.
But I guess I blinked my eyes or something at one point. Now all of a sudden we have this all in an external field. It's not a microcanonical.
No, this is to test the fermion properties. But this was actually the last plot. So now come to the dynamics. So the first thing to discuss is, so now we come to the real-time dynamics, have the full equation for the Bose fields and the back reaction of the fermions, and look how this, take a certain initial condition and look how it evolves in real time. The first thing to discuss is the divergence, the quantum divergence, because here is a one-loop fermion contribution to the scalar self energy, which, if you just calculate it, is logarithmically divergent. So want to see if that is indeed present in the equations of motion. And if you do look at the equation for the scalar field, you take for convenience these values of Bose fields, you find that this equation becomes just a gap equation with a mode sum on this side. And if you do this mode sum, this mode sum gives you a highly non-linear equation in the Yukawa coupling and the expectation value. But if you expand it, you find that indeed there is a logarithmically divergent sum present on the right side of the gap equation. So what it means that it boils down to this equation, where you have a renormalized expectation value, which is finite, a bare parameter, which is formally infinite and which should cancel the logarithmic divergence on this part. So this is just this is the standard one loop divergence, let's say. So what you do in practice is to fix the renormalized value and then find the corresponding bare parameter by solving this gap equation was on top, which is here. And it simply means that if I change my number of mode functions or my lattice basically change the lattice spacing, I have to change the bare parameters so that the renormalized physics is the same, because this is standard quantum field theory approach. And indeed, it also works. It's also nice, of course. So I plotted here phi squared for some initial condition. And this is without renormalization. So here the bare parameter is kept the same, but I change my lattice spacing. So I change the number of lattice points in the same physical volume. And what you see is that the three curves, they shift. So they don't fall on top of each other, which is, of course, what you expect, because I keep the same bare parameter. So let's now do it correctly and change the bare parameter as given by this gap equation. And what you now see, again for three lattice spacing, is that the curves fall on top of each other, except, well, and the one which is the most off here is the one for n equals 16, so the one with the largest lattice spacing. So what you see here is a convergence towards the continuum limit, let's say. So this is renormalization in really the practical point of view. Well, and it also happens, of course, for other observables. So this is for the same run as for phi squared, but this is for the Church-Simons number, which is oscillating around zero. Here, the numbers, the curves shift if I keep the bare parameters the same. And if I change the bare parameter curve according to what I should do, I find that the curves fall on top of each other, where these, again, the biggest discrepancy is for largest lattice spacing, so smallest n. So this is what I said in the introduction about the renormalization of the effective equations of motion, that you can see where the divergences are, and choose the correct bare parameters to cancel these divergences. So now continue and show you some plots for a non-equilibrium situation, because you. This configuration or this real-time evolution is kind of dull because there is not much energy present. So all it does is just oscillates and gets damped and things like that. That's interesting to compare, let's say, linear response theory and see how it gets damped. But now put in more initial energy. So how we do that? It's in the following way. The fermions are initially in vacuum, so the standard expectation values, and all the initial energy is in the long wavelengths of the Bose fields. So this is a typical example where phi is equal to a renormalized expectation value. A has a small part, but basically all the energy is put in the time derivatives of the Bose fields, but just two smooth waves on the lattice. Now, what happens then? Typically looks like this. With the total energy, the energy in the Bose fields and the energy in the fermions. The energy in the fermions is zero, so it's renormalized to subtract the energy from the Dirac C, let's say, the field Dirac C. And all the initial energies in the Bose fields. This is a non-equilibrium situation. And what happens is that there is energy transfer towards the fermions. And this is very similar to inflation, I would say, where you would have particle production in the fermions due to a Bose field which has a large amplitude, larger than its natural amplitude would be. Now, what happens to a typical observable is the following. So this is the Church-Simons number and the actual charge. And what you see that in the beginning, the actual charges of the Church-Simons number and the actual charge are rapidly varying. But as the energy of the Bose fields becomes less and less, the Church-Simons number starts to feel, let's say, the Svalerum varies, and it starts to spend more time in certain vacua or wiggling in certain vacua, and still makes rapid transitions. And the energy goes down, and here it settles in one ground state. Well, maybe later on it will do something again, but it settles in one ground state. And the actual charge follows the Church-Simons number, which is expected from the anomaly equation. Although this is for Yukawa coupling zero, where we expect no problems at all, because what I showed you with the external Bose fields for finite Yukawa coupling, there are some problems.
So the actual charge.
This Q5, so it's just like this blue curve here. Yeah. That is the actual charge of the fermions. Yeah.
Is that an integer?
It's not an integer. No. It's just.
It's an expectation value.
Well, it turns out that this may look like a long time. 3,000 in units ET, but it's not. You can't really say here if it will accumulate or not.
There's many volume questions, right? Isn't that EL?
EL is the physical volume. Yeah. So it is fairly long times for. What if you just I show you 15 times as long as this. So if you know that this is not long time.
But you should expect the periodicity and everything to play well if you.
The spatial periodicity, you mean?
Yeah, so
be running for a very long time compared to the time it would take for cluster volume.
Yeah.
So the system may behave differently from the system in
which is bigger, yeah. Okay, that's yeah.
Well, do you have a comment on that?
Well, the analysis is nice in finite volume. Uh-huh. And then everything is periodic. The transitive number is defined only modulo n, the number of flat sides in space. So you see those effects.
Do you ever see recurrences?
No.
Yeah, here along the calibration we follow from the fact that in this case, I mean, color coupling didn't have a zero in the system. So obviously, the presence of zero mode, the calibration slows down.
What do you mean by the zero mode? You mean massless fermion?
Right, it is so clear the bottlenecked picture, I don't know how to explain it in this picture. It's probably, it probably is the massless.
Yeah, they're not really zero mode. I should say that the system is not really big. Yeah, I mean, so that's. So. I will skip some things because time is happily running forward. So. I'll just go to the long time behavior, and I would say very long time behavior, which is, and well, I will not present really answer, but just show you some results, whether does the system come to some sort of equilibrium, and well, some sort of equilibrium even in an unspecified sense, so I won't say if it's thermal or something like that, but just show you some results, but typically all with the same initial conditions. So all the energy is initially in the long wavelengths of the, let's say, of the conjugate momentum of the Higgs field, and where you can tune how much energy is there by tuning, well, playing with these initial amplitudes and adding another wave to it, and just see what happens. So this is, I would say, really long time behavior, because this is 45,000, which is 15 times as long as on the previous time. And so the funny thing is that all the previous things were in this part. So all the, let's say, non-equilibrium, really non-equilibrium things are happening here. But if you look at much later times, you see that the energy transfer basically settles and the Bose fields just keep approximately this. This energy, the fermions have approximately this energy. So in this point, this doesn't change very much. Of course, it doesn't tell you anything about how it microscopically looks like. So what I've plotted here is the charge density of the Higgs field. This might look as a complicated plot, but there are, well, I will tell you what you can see if you look at them. So this is space direction. So this is what n equals 32. So this is space and lattice point from 0 to 32. And this is time for the same run as before. And here you see a kind of smooth curve, which is the initial condition. But then what happens very soon is that the system just is fully interacting and inhomogeneous. And what happens is that, well, the amplitude drops down, which is related to the energy of the Bose fields goes down. But then it's just an happily fluctuating situation, which, you want to...
What's the spec?
Well, that we didn't calculate. So, yeah.
But
so
the ratio of energies and fermions and bosons, does it follow usual thermodynamic relation?
Well, that we also don't know.
We try, but we have to go through a bit of that.
That's a kind of point.
It's
modes that are in the Fermi distribution to read just the usual formulas, like density goes like feet to power.
How about you put just different data from for your companies that we use, you could just make a static simulation.
What do you mean?
Compute what is the energy ratio between fermions and bosons.
The computer has a finite volume with your
I mean, this looks like you want to do something with it, but I mean, I'm only presenting a typical snapshot. Oh, not a snapshot because it's in time, but a typical what a typical configuration looks like. And well, due to a large density of workshops, this is what I can show. And
workshops are interfering with the work.
Yeah. So this is the same. This is the same plot, but this is for the fermion charge. And here you have a straight line, which saying that initially there was no the charge density was zero and homogeneous, and then also I mean it's interacting with the inhomogeneous Bose field, so it also becomes inhomogeneous and looks like this. Okay, so let me see. Time and space. Yeah. Well, I find it hard to see if it gets kinky or not. But
Yeah. Because you know how to normalize the theory.
Yeah, but still, one of my possible caveats. I mean, we know how to do the smooth Bose field, but what happens when you really think that's a bit wild? Is it still okay?
I mean, the equations of motion,
falls outside your established picture.
Well, that's already very bad, as we established this morning. No, I don't understand why renormalization theory would be different if I had the mean field. Okay.
Well, okay, yeah, we can put it in maybe two or three discussion sessions. Well, just to show you that numerical precision is not really a problem. This is the maximal violation of the local Gauss law, and this is for these very long times, and it just stays with 10 to the minus 10, so... Which is, I mean, solve a large number of partial differential equations. So
you don't actually readjust Gauss.
No, this is
let it do what it do. Yeah.
This is the maximal violation at one side. So and this is the maximal at each time step. This is the maximal violation at one of the sides. So and then plot that, and this looks fine. So well, the total energy has larger fluctuations, but that's because the lattice formulation is designed that if there are exact symmetries which correspond to exact conservation laws, and this is basically gauge invariance, and that's an exact symmetry. So this one is very good. But the total energy not, that's like in a leapfrog.
This is the difference with just machine accuracy.
This is machine accuracy.
Conserved exactly, then this is machine.
Yeah, right. This is the point. So I mean
checking how the computer works.
Yeah, checking how the computer works. Yeah, that's right. Didn't make any mistakes in writing code or something like that. So let me finish by showing you a result for Pauli blocking, which is funny to show, but I think at least. So we have fermions. So you might wonder what happens. Well, you always might wonder what happens, but might wonder what happens with Pauli blocking. We have non-equilibrium initial conditions, and there is energy transfer from the Bose fields to the fermions. So the question is, can this energy transfer go on forever? And the answer is no, because of Pauli blocking. If you just would calculate the particle numbers, the occupation numbers, you, of course, from the Pauli principle, you get that the occupation number has to be smaller or equal to 1. But to actually do this calculation at a certain time would require a space and time dependent Borg-Hubbert transformation, which is kind of involved, and we didn't do that. However, you can also look at the energy, the total energy of the fermions, because if I look at this like in a heuristic way, then the maximal energy that can be present in the fermions is if you completely fill all the states which are present. So we started out with a vacuum state, so only the Dirac C is filled, but you saw that there was fermion production because of energy transfer, and the maximal fermion production that can happen is when all the states are filled. Now if you calculate this energy, it's just simply sum of all states, you find that for our parameters we take, and this with our show, and for n equals 32, this is, well, it's number 815. So let's look what happens. So what I do is but I show you is this, which is I put enormous amount of energy in the Bose fields, much more than before. I had like 300 or 800. This is much more. So there is again energy transfer from the bosons to the fermions, but suddenly there is a very sharp change here, and the energy stays constant, but and fluctuating. And if you look more
certainly at this level, one could do what I think
Dominated by the lattice artifacts.
Almost filled.
Yeah.
Well,
so it's Pauli blocking.
Why momentum also be filled. If you have a certain energy that corresponds to a certain temperature, you would expect that the most is energy much higher than temperature.
This is not physics. Well, Pauli blocking is physics, but this situation is not physics.
Okay, the other question,
the idea you have is that these low-lying positive energy states are filled with some like 1 minus F probability, F being the Fermi Dirac distribution. But
yeah.
To actually get a temperature out of there, then you would need a bigger lattice because.
Why can't you
do a lower end?
I showed you before. This is for fun, right? This is to show you. I mean. Oh, it's from very precise. So this is just the fermion energy, and the number was 8, in the corner, 815. And now the 8 is gone again. Okay, so, and it comes like this. And if you, I zoomed in a bit more because people might want to know how precise it is. So I get this. Wow, it's happily fluctuating. Well, I mean, it being exactly in this state is because it's a static. Like a static spectrum, but if you look at the average, which is around here, it looks pretty good, like 815.
Yeah.
I mean, what?
But how can it be above?
It can be above. It's very simple because this state in this picture is not at the maximum. I mean, it can go around.
Yeah, but there is a maximum, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's like if you think about in what happens when you change the Church-Simons number, then all these states shift up. So I would say an absolutely maximum, then all these states are shift to here, but
okay.
That's not what happens.
Is this free gas?
No,
but this picture is.
This picture is a free gas, yeah.
It's free gas, so but it's surprising they're so small.
Yeah.
Because in the master, you have like the.
Well, that is in the calculation.
I know, but
yeah. No, but in the 815. Okay, but the Bose fields are still wildly fluctuating, which gives a fluctuating mass term in the
there is no exact notion of particle for fermion because it's in the oscillating background.
So the average looks.
Right.
I mean that's. So the summary is like this. We looked at an inhomogeneous classical Bose field or a mean field coupled to a quantized fermion field. Well, we think it's convenient to use a lattice in real time you take into account the effect of fermion doubling. Well, as Jan already said, it's in 1+1 dimensions, which makes it numerically possible, but in 3+1 it would be harder to take into account all the mode functions. And I showed you several results for the anomaly, Fermi number violation, renormalizability, Sveiller transitions, long time behavior Pauli blocking. That's the summary, so that was it.